Welcome to the Boom Clap Podcast, the declining healthcare system. That is what we're going to talk about today. It's been on my mind heavy for the last couple weeks, especially as the mandates keep rolling out in my area. I have many nurse friends who are set to lose their jobs very soon. And while this isn't a new problem, I've discussed this before, you know, it's not a new problem. Healthcare has been on the decline for quite some time. It is just rapidly picking up pace and it is much more noticeable. I think even to the public to some degree, but mainly to those of us who have worked inside that system. I was talking to Cecily earlier today, and we were just discussing, you know, what we wanted to talk about and what the topic of conversation would be. And I told her that on the way home from dropping my kids off at school, I had this like whole dissertation in my head about the healthcare system. And the analogy that came to mind for me, just based on the fact that the public tends to not be aware of how healthcare should be, is just that if you go to a restaurant and you get chicken, say you order chicken and you taste it and it doesn't taste right, like, you know how chicken is supposed to taste. You know if you get a bad dish because, you know, even if you've never ever worked in a restaurant before, you know how, you know, good food should taste that is not rotten, that is not spoiled, right? Mm-hmm. But if you go into a hospital, most people don't know what healthcare should look like. The basis of what they know is like, is my surgeon or is my doctor coming in and seeing me? And is my nurse responsive to my call lights and to my requests? But most people don't know what healthcare should look like. And examples of that, like, these are real life examples. You know, your surgeon walks in post-op day one from open heart surgery and asks the nurse, is this patient being paced? You as a patient don't know that your doctor should know what a paced rhythm looks like. They shouldn't have to ask the nurse if your patient, if the patient's being paced. But this is a real life scenario and the patient has no clue. And there are so many situations like this, and healthcare can decline, healthcare can go downhill, and people don't know because they don't know what it's supposed to look like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And like I was saying to Rita, like, I don't have any experience in the ICU at all. And I live in a different country than her. And our healthcare system looks different in general. But we're seeing the same thing here. And in the area that I have experienced, it's community care, like home and community care. And what it looked like when I started was not great. Like, it was really quite bad. But what it looked like when I finished about 2 years ago, it was much, much worse. And from what I hear from the people, the friends that I have that are still working in that sector, it's gotten so bad to the point they can't hold staff. The staff that they have is incredibly burnt out and no longer the same people that they used to be. And the patients, we call them in community care, we call them clients, or at least we do here, but it's just terrible. Like, the way it's run is shocking and terrible. And most people don't realize it until they have a loved one who is in need of that sort of care. They all of a sudden realize, like, oh my goodness, the system's incredibly broken. But like Rita said, it's a little bit more obvious in home and community care when the system is completely broken. But most people, as Rita has said many times, have never seen the inside of an ICU or even a surgical ward and have no idea how things are supposed to look. And it's harder to detect if it's broken when you don't know what you're looking for.
Yeah, exactly. I just actually talked to a friend today who used to work with me also. And this friend was pulled aside by another friend who frequently visits people in the hospital. And they were like, hey, oh my gosh, I went to visit this person the other day. What is happening at your hospital? It was not like this 6 months ago. They said, you know, nobody was to be found. The patient they went to visit needed assistance using the restroom. No one was to be found. They finally found a healthcare tech, and this healthcare tech was covered up doing something else for another patient and just couldn't get to them. And they were like, oh, your nurse is at lunch. I'm sorry. But just so understaffed. And they were just saying, you know, this isn't even what it was like 6 months ago. And similarly to your situation in home healthcare, when you said, you know, things were bad when you started, I kind of felt the same way hospital wise. I mean, I think every nurse goes into healthcare knowing it's not an ideal scenario, right? Mm-hmm. Your workload's going to be heavy. It's going to be hard. Staffing has always been an issue. I mean, I've been a nurse for 15 and a half, almost 16 years now. And I remember in nursing school, like, we discussed staffing issues. Like, it's always mm-hmm. been a problem. But the thing is, it's been a slow decline that is rapidly sped up. And I think that when you talk about healthcare where you see improvements in technology. And yeah. I think seeing improvements in technology is good, but it's also released personal responsibility because as you've seen these increases and improvements in technology, the ability of individuals to detect problems, use their own capabilities has declined. And it's almost like that decline hasn't been noticeable because of the improvement in technology, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I feel like it's really excited. I mean, it's really excited. It's really easy to get excited about advances in technology, especially when that technology can help people improve their health, at least in the short term, right? Like, that's a very measurable thing. But I mean, you have said before too, like, there's, you know, these, I can't think of the correct word for it right now, but basically
algorithms.
Yeah, algorithms and flowcharts for, like, you know, what you're looking for and the care you're going to provide. And that can be good and bad, right? But if it becomes something that we become so dependent on, we can't see outside the box for yeah. something else that might be going on. Like, it's, in a way, like, we've said this, not even regarding healthcare, but we've said this for other things, like, technology isn't making us smarter. It's allowing us to shut off key components of our brain that have always been helpful
yes.
to humanity, right?
Yes.
And when that starts happening in healthcare, which is where we go in emergency situations, that's a really, really dangerous thing. Add to that the staffing issues and you've got a real problem. Like, when you were giving the example of the patient who needed to use the bathroom and needed some assistance to get there, like, as someone who's been in healthcare for years, your mind immediately goes to, like, that seems like such a minor thing, but it's not.
It's major.
When you know yeah. what can go wrong when someone doesn't get the help they need to just go to the bathroom. Like, if this is an elderly patient who's possibly confused or at least, you know, dependent on someone helping them with their mobility, but they really need to go and they decide to go on their own and they fall. And, you know, like, there's so many things that can go wrong when there's just the simple task of not helping someone to the bathroom. When there's no one available for something as simple as that, it can cause a huge cascade of events that put the patient in a much worse scenario than they were before.
Right. We've had sentinel events because patients have gotten up on their own, simply that mm-hmm. one little thing. And I think, like you were saying, as technology improves, we forget the small things, and those small things are really big things. And I'm thinking of specific ways that we've improved in the hospital since I started. When I started, an open heart surgery that didn't go well in the OR, they would bring the patient up and they would call us and be like, hey, you need to get the family back here right away because this patient isn't going to make it. Now we have ECMO, so we can put a patient on ECMO.
Right.
And instead of taking them off bypass, they just, you know, switch them over to ECMO and bring them up, and they can, quote, live sometimes with the same outcome, often with the same outcome, but live for several days. So things are different and things have improved, and it makes things look mm-hmm. different and seem a little mm-hmm. less dramatic. Maybe mm-hmm. vascular surgeries. We're able to do so many more vascular surgeries non-invasively, you know, without opening someone up. Yeah. I shouldn't say non-invasively. It's invasive, but
always, yeah.
Without opening someone into, like, endo surgeries. And so that has changed how things look. And so things look better. They seem easier, but it isn't necessarily the case. And as you said, I think that, like you said, when somebody gets that technology, it allows them to shut parts of their brain off. I think that is what we are seeing. And I think that outcomes, maybe I'm having a hard time like trying to explain this in a way that's understandable, mm-hmm. but I'm envisioning these meetings we've had with higher ups that are like, well, what you're saying you're seeing doesn't really match up with outcomes. Our outcomes are about the same. Okay, but could our outcomes be like this much better if the people mm-hmm. were the caliber that we had before? You know what I mean? Because the technology's improved, if the people had stayed at least the same caliber, like would our outcomes be even better? Does that make sense?
Yeah. Like if technology is improving and that's such a good thing, then you should see outcomes improve. Mm-hmm. And if the outcomes aren't improving despite the better technology, then you have to ask, okay, what has declined, right? Because if something got better and it should make outcomes better, but the outcomes are just the same, clearly there's something holding it back.
Yeah.
And I feel like that assessment is missing. And I feel like, and don't get us wrong, we are not saying that technology is bad and we're not saying that medical advancements are bad. That's not what we're saying.
But they're there has good, to but... be this,
yeah, there has to be this accountability and responsibility mm-hmm. that comes with it. Because I will say, just in the environment that I've worked, anytime we've had any major change, something that wouldn't really apply to the ICU, but that does apply to home and community care is scheduling. And I mean scheduling for like nurses or community health workers to go see clients in the community. And so how we used to do it is we would have schedulers in the office in the local area scheduling for the local area. And we would have community health workers that worked in that area. Okay. And it would all be scheduled by the schedulers that know the geography, that knew the clients, that knew the workers, that knew their nursing supervisor. But then we had this big change where they, you know, they got these new systems, what they called centralized the scheduling. And anytime you hear that word centralized, mm-hmm. you really need to like sit up and pay attention and run the opposite direction. It was a disaster. So they took all of the schedulers for all of Fraser Health and they put them, which is a really big health, it's the biggest health authority in our province. And they placed them all in one city, despite the fact that, you know, the area that I was in charge of extended way out into mountain towns with like tiny populations that had like one road in, one road out. And it was a disaster. Like the community health workers couldn't get to the clients weren't getting their care, and people were being yelled at on the daily on the phone by upset family members, and clients suffered. And the healthcare workers suffered. And it was all because we had this fancy new system and we decided to centralize. And it absolutely destroyed everything because we shut off our thinking skills when we got the new system. But if we would have had the new system and kept the thinking skills going, we would have kept schedulers that know geography and knew our clients. And you know what I mean? If we would have worked in tandem with the technology, things would have gone really well. But because we strictly relied on the technology, things went really, really badly.
Yeah, I mean, that makes total sense. And it's just like brings me to the point of you have to keep people that know what they're doing, because yep. this isn't a game of just being able to push buttons and follow an algorithm. Mm-hmm. This is mm-hmm. a game of like, having experience in understanding situations and being able to think on your feet and think critically about these situations that you have been involved with for years. It's about all of that. It's about putting those pieces together, and you can't have robots doing the job, and you can't rely on some centralized system to figure things out where the human connection yeah. is a desirable component, you know?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
I don't know. It's just this whole scenario in the healthcare system. There's so much I want to say here, you guys, but there's so much I don't know how to say without like getting in trouble or something by, you know, I don't know if that makes sense. Like there are scenarios that I could point to that you guys would be like, oh my gosh, like this is actually really important. But I don't know if I can point to those scenarios legally, I guess. Anyway.
You know what? I think what I'll do, I'll read a little snippet from the article I sent you this morning. So this is specifically talking about Canadian healthcare, and obviously there's big differences between Canadian healthcare and American healthcare. But so this is just a little snippet from a National Post article. On healthcare, we seem mesmerized by the illusion of universality. Smug in the assumption that our system is at least better than that of the US, we accept meekly a situation in which demand far exceeds supply, where rationing and delays are chronic, and shortages of family doctors and modern equipment are alarming. The price we pay for a free system, in quotes, one that is neither free nor universal. Throwing more money at a faltering system is not the answer. Political leaders shy away from fundamental changes to a service that is 60 years old, as if genuine reform represented a political third rail. No party in the last election offered more than money as a solution, and that is a failure of democracy. I'm going to skip the next paragraph and move on to this part where it says, we allow exceptions for private care in Quebec, but why not in Canada as a whole? A portion of private medical care may violate sensibilities about equity, but the element of competition does demonstrably improve the standard of care. A competitive spirit is basic to our democratic capitalist mode of life. Why not for healthcare? We should allow for experimentation, adapting the best practices of mixed public and private systems prevalent in Europe. That would improve the quality of care and relieve pressure on the public system. So in Canada, the health system here, it's all about equitable access, right? But here's the thing, access isn't equitable if no one can access it, right? So obviously this isn't necessarily a problem in the US, but this is a huge problem in Canada. And I just think it's something worth talking about. And I mean, we can compare and contrast it to issues that you guys have in the States, but you know, we seem to be so worried about the buzzwords of equity and inclusion that we forget that when we're trying so hard to do that, no one gets the care they need. And there's ridiculously long wait lists for MRIs and CTs and surgeries and even cancer treatment. And it's disgusting. And if we would just in Canada allow for some of that competition between private and public, things would improve for everyone and the access would be more equitable because the people that could pay for private care would then go to private care, therefore opening up access to the public system. You know what I mean? And I know this is kind of off the rails because it's not necessarily about technology, but it's a huge issue within the healthcare system.
Well, it's not off the rails because this isn't just about technology. The healthcare system itself is a mess. And, you know, the United States isn't far behind.
No.
We have a partially socialized system right now.
Yeah.
I personally very much believe that this current scenario with the way things are moving, they are pushing for the public to clamor for a socialized medical system, a wholly socialized system, by way of quietly destroying it, I believe somewhat on purpose. You know, this isn't by accident anymore. We know what's happening. And somebody actually sent me a message tonight and was like, I just can't figure out what's in it for the hospitals. Like, why would they want this? Like, why would they want the short staffing? Oh, and I can read. She was referring also to a legislation in the state of Illinois. And she was like, they won't get paid. I'm like, well, not by the insurance company, but they'll still get paid. And I said, I think that for the most part within the hospital system itself, no, there's no real, you know, carrot for them to follow this other than public perception is huge. And when you get the public calling for something so hardcore, they want to please the public. And then you have all of these people in administration at these hospitals, at least at my hospital. And I, from what I hear, I don't think it's much different anywhere else. They're all the woke mob. And so they this is how they think. And they don't think about the actual consequences of what they're doing right now.
No. Which is like, okay, so we talked a little bit about brainwashing in the last episode. Mm-hmm. Obviously, brainwashing is a negative thing, but we kind of flipped it on its head a little bit and talked about washing the brain. But this is an example of brainwashing in a really bad way. This woke mob, you know, like they have been conditioned to believe that they should go for something despite the fact that it's clearly bringing destruction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's alarming.
Yeah. I'm just, my head hurts trying to grasp how these people construct this in their head to be a good thing. Okay, I mentioned that bill, so I'm just going to read that so you guys can hear what I'm talking about. So this is HB 4259. If you're in Illinois, you can get on ILGA.gov and look it up. But it's insurance code healthcare expenses, sponsored by Representative Jonathan Carroll. Okay, synopsis is introduced. Amends the Illinois Insurance Code, provides that a group or individual policy of accident in health insurance that is amended, delivered, issued, or renewed on or after January 1st, 2023 shall provide that a person who is eligible to receive a COVID-19 vaccine and chooses not to be vaccinated shall pay for healthcare expenses out of pocket if the person becomes hospitalized because of COVID-19 symptoms. Read that last word carefully. Not because of COVID-19, but COVID-19 symptoms. So that broadly opens it to anything. Insurance, bucking, paying on anything almost. And so this is a major problem. This is tying your healthcare choices to your insurability. And these aren't healthcare choices. Like, almost every patient we get in the ICU, I know I have said this multiple times, but almost every patient we get in the ICU has made lifestyle choices that have either led to or contributed to them being in that position. And so why is this particular thing a reason for insurance not to pay? You know, insurance is going to pay for your, you know, cellulitis in your leg from your type 2 diabetes, you know,
And most of the times, I don't know exactly how it works down there, but before you get an insurance policy, that's when they do this health screening, right? And, you know, if you're a smoker, maybe they'll up your, what's it called?
I can't think of the word.
Yeah, that's it. If you're a smoker, they'll up your premium. If you have a high risk lifestyle, they'll up your premium. But these are all things done on the front end before you even have the insurance. You know what I mean? And so now here we are with people that already have insurance. And now they're being like approached with this clause that's saying that if you don't do this, we won't cover your medical costs, which is ridiculous, especially when you consider, I don't know what the numbers are down there, but almost 40% of the people that are hospitalized with COVID here have received the vaccine.
Exactly. So what happens if you get COVID, you're in the hospital with COVID, but you had the vaccine, insurance pays then because you are a good little boy or good little girl and did what you were supposed to.
Yeah. It'd be one thing. And I say it'd be one thing, but it still wouldn't because this is a personal choice, but at least there might be some logic to it. If the vaccine was 100% effective and carried zero risk. But it's not 100% effective and it does carry risk. So why, like, it's crazy to me.
Yeah. And this is just an example of how they are trying to infiltrate your medical decisions and influence your medical decisions by way of basically making it impossible for you not to follow suit in order to afford medical care, right?
Ugh,
I don't know.
So gross. It's really gross. It goes back to the whole breaking of the will situation. Like, they just push and push and push until your will is broken and you get in line. And that's not how humans should be treated. Like, it's so dehumanizing. It's like a horse that needs to be broke to be ridden, you know? Like, no, humans aren't animals. We're not to be dehumanized. Oh, it's bad.
And that's exactly what they're doing. Like, that's exactly what they're doing right now. I know, like, in my hospital,
the horse with the spurs, like, until it submits, essentially.
Yeah. In my hospital right now, or my former hospital, they have been approving and denying declinations for the last couple of weeks. And actually, they just, a person had messaged in a group today. I'm in a group with many nurses and techs and other healthcare workers from that hospital who are all on a similar page. And one of them said that there are a few that still haven't even heard whether they got approved or denied. And today was the deadline. And they sent out an email today, I guess, or their supervisor. I think their supervisor told them that they got an email today that said, if you haven't heard you got denied, we've had a problem with the email system. I'm like, your job is hanging in the balance. And we can't even do you the honor of like giving you an email to tell you you were denied. It's just like, oh, sorry, the system's messed up. And, you know, we can't let you know because, it's just ridiculous. But anyway, they are denying and approving people. And just to give you a picture of how ridiculous this whole setup is, I have gotten messages from more than one person, a handful of people who have gotten an approved flu exemption and a denied COVID exemption, or vice versa, an approved COVID exemption and denied flu, with the exact same language. So your religious beliefs are good enough for one of the vaccines, but not the other. And then other people who've, like, a spouse has been denied and they've been approved. I have a friend today that I read an email that she was about to send, and just talking through, you know, who bears the burden? If something happens to me when I get this vaccine, who bears the responsibility of explaining to my daughter that something happened to her mom because her religious beliefs were not good enough for Carle Hospital? And in a scenario where our hospital has this diversity, equity, and inclusivity department in place, and they've been hammering this language down our throat. They sent out emails all the time. They make you take these tests to make sure you're compliant in diversity, equity, and inclusivity. Why would an employee feel inclined to ask why her religious beliefs weren't good enough? You know, that shouldn't even be a thing. So, but this whole scenario, the whole reason for talking about these declinations and getting approved and denied and all of this in this podcast episode, it's not just about these nurses losing their job. It's not about respiratory therapists and healthcare techs and everybody losing their job. That is a big deal. Mm-hmm. But what goes along with them losing their job is those experience years lost at that hospital, good employees lost. And this will impact every single person. And I think that it's so hard for people to stand up right now because they don't know exactly what they're fighting for. If you don't know what you're fighting for, it's hard to fight. And when you think you're fighting just for yourself, it's hard to fight. But when you realize this fight is so much bigger than you, that it's about everyone right now, it's a lot easier to stand up.
Well, it's also hard to fight when the popular messaging all around you is telling you that you're fighting for the wrong thing. You know, like, basically, if you're fighting for this, you're selfish and you don't care about people. And it's really the exact opposite, right? But people don't necessarily see that. So it gets confusing. Like, it absolutely gets confusing. And it's hard to fight when you're being told that you're fighting for the wrong thing.
Heck yeah, that's totally right, Cecily. I mean, I like am so mentally in the spot I am. Like, I know for a fact that this vaccine can cause harm. It's okay. If you want to take it, take it. If you don't want to, don't. I know that. I know that it doesn't stop transmission. Like, I know that. But yet I can see that there are people getting sick. And so when this message is hammered home to you so many times, you do question yourself. Like, even I stand there and question myself sometimes, like, what in the heck am I doing? And I am so like hard-nosed on this, and yet I can question myself. So like, I can't imagine where other people are mentally with this.
Oh, absolutely. Like, there are days where I'm just like, oh, maybe I am a terrible person, but it's just, yeah, but it's like, but then I remember, no, because I do have compassion for the people that have gotten really sick with this. Mm-hmm. And I do have compassion for people who have lost family members and friends to this illness. Like, there's no part of me that doesn't have compassion or doesn't think that it's worth being cautious. But I mean, I'm honestly a little bit of a hypochondriac, like not for like big things, but I don't like picking, like if I go to the grocery store, I wash my hands before I touch anything that I own. You know what I mean? Like, I don't like picking up gross things in different places when I'm out and about. But where am I going with this story?
I don't know, but I'm laughing because I can relate to some of what you're saying.
Yeah. Well, and so it's like, it's not like, I think where I'm going, I totally lost my train of thought as I was like going on about this. But it's like, it's not like I'm a person that denies that people can get sick. And it's not like I'm saying like, to heck with everything. If you're sick, just go out anyway, you know, like infect everyone around you. No, like I'm a rational human. Like if you're sick, stay home. But it's like, wow, to the point that we've taken this is absolutely, I don't know. It's just, it's heartbreaking. And I was explaining to some friends last night that, you know, if you're more, people tend to be on a spectrum, right? Like you're either more emotional or more logical, and you're usually closer to one of those spectrums. I'm definitely closer to the logical spectrum. And I realize that about myself. But it's because of that, it's almost painful to see the lack of logic that's happening right now, and to see people being painted with this broad brush, and to see people losing their livelihoods because of a decision they're making based on something that doesn't make a whole lot of sense. You know, like it's almost physically painful for me.
Right. That's the thing. Like the people that I'm seeing making decisions within these hospital systems are on the emotional spectrum.
Yes.
Okay. So story on that. At my hospital, this must have happened like right after I had left, because it was like early September when one of my friends sent me pictures of this. There was a room. So some of the nurses on my unit had been having like some emotional struggles, and that's okay. Like I'm not making fun of that scenario.
No,
that's not the point. The point is we have we have a big waiting room, but then we also have two conference rooms right outside of the ICU. And, they're like little rooms that we would like put families in if they're having like their family member is dying, or like they're in a really like critical situation and we need to have them close by so that we can discuss with them. Or if we need to have a family care conference, like those are what those rooms are for, and they're private and for families. Well, my friend sends me this picture. They've turned one of the rooms into it's got a person's name. And then it's like, I can't remember exactly what they called it, but literally pictures in the room, there are plastic swords. Did I tell you about this already on Boxer?
No.
Oh my gosh. Plastic swords, a quick yoga book, like 1 minute yoga, sand, like a little thing with sand in it, and rakes. You can rake through sand.
Right.
It's like some kind of quiet room where you can go and decompress during the day if you're a nurse. Took away a family area and made it into this, like, it looks like a child's play area. Like there's sand and plastic swords. And
what are the swords?
I don't know. Like, I know I sound like I'm making fun of the situation, but it's just like, this is where leadership in our hospital is mentally. It's like a play area for emotional wellness. And it's like, there are so many other ways to handle that. And it just, to me, it shows that like, people don't have a good foundation when it comes to their emotional well-being. And a good foundation for me is my spiritual well-being, right? Mm-hmm. And Mm-hmm. I know that so many people that I work with are lacking that. And so I have compassion for that. But it's just like, when you brought that up about people being more in the emotional spectrum, like, that is the first thing that came to my mind, because I cannot imagine 15 years ago seeing something like that inside my hospital. Not 10 years ago.
Oh,
like, but people are so, people are so incapable of handling their emotions that they're going to take 10 minutes out of their day and go play in sand or play sword fight with another nurse. Yeah. Like, what in the world?
Yeah. and like, don't get me wrong, like, emotional wellness is super important. But
yes, it is.
At what expense, right? Like, we literally took a room from something that was really critical, actually, to patient care. Mm-hmm. So, okay, this, what you brought up.
Like, I'm sorry. This was like a tangent.
Don't be. No. It leads me into something else I want to talk to, and it's shifting gears a little bit, but I think you'll get on board. So with people being incapable of kind of like regulating their emotions and handling things, processing things well, this comes back to the education system. Okay. And it's not the only thing it comes back to, but it does come back to this in part. And my husband, as you guys know, he's a public school teacher. From when he started, I don't even know how many years ago, maybe 11 or 12, when he started teaching to now, it's like a different world, a different world. And I cannot believe the things that he comes home and tells me. And like, at his school, in 1 week, they had 8 suicide assessments. 8. And this is a small school. Yeah. And this is not to rag on those kids. It's the opposite of that. We are failing these kids. We are failing them as a society. And this has never happened that it's been that big of a number before. But these numbers are steadily going up. The rates of depression and suicide and anxiety and just inability to handle life is going up. Kids aren't allowed to fail grades anymore. Like, they're just not. Like, there are kids in his grade 7, 8 math classes that are like, not kids with any major special needs or anything, that are doing math at a level that is below my grade 5 and grade 3 son. Just because they are just being pushed along through the system because, heaven forbid, we fail them. And we are setting them up for failure. Forget failing a grade. These kids are going to have to graduate, in quotes, graduate high school and either move on to high school or some sort of job, but they are not going to be prepared for it because they haven't been prepared for it. And yes, their emotional wellness is important, but perhaps we're crippling them more by insulating their world. You know what I mean? And I don't think their whole world is insulated. Obviously, most of these kids that are really struggling, they come from really rough homes. And that's why they struggle so much, right? And that is worthy of compassion and care and extra diligence. But I say diligence very intentionally, because diligence doesn't just mean wrapping them in bubble wrap when they're in the secure environment of school. Right? It means supporting them in any way they need support. And that includes strengthening of character and strengthening of fortitude. So I don't know. And so this is happening in elementary school. This is happening in middle school. This is happening in high school. And I'm going to read something from that article, that same article that I quoted from earlier. I'm going to read about how it's affecting higher education as well. It just goes on and on. So higher education is following a similar mediocre path. So it's comparing it to the mediocre path of the healthcare system. But higher education is following a similar mediocre path. Our institutions are not developing the skills and talents our society needs. By dumbing down standards in order to bolster enrollment, they focus less on excellence. The price of the enrollment number games is mediocrity. A Sputnik-like jolt is needed to rebalance the funding focus from bums in seats to productive brain power. Universities know that we need more graduates with engineering, science, and computer science skills and fewer with sociology degrees, and yet do little to rectify the imbalance. The net result is too many graduates lacking fundamental creative skills essential to a healthy economy. We rely on immigration to fill the skills gap, but with more emphasis now on family class immigrants, that is a depleting resource. So, I don't know. I just think we're not setting kids up properly to go out into the world. You know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure. I mean,
that was a long rant.
That's what we talked about in the last episode, just in our own homes. Like, that's our responsibility. And I understand, like, the frustration with the institutions, absolutely. But what I keep coming back to with everything, you know, whether it is, like, when people say, oh, it's Biden's fault. Yeah, whatever. Mm-hmm. That's great. But who voted for him? You know?
Yeah.
When it's the university's fault, okay, great. But people make up the institution, right? Yes. And so none of these things get to this point without a society that's moving that direction. And so it's our job in our own individual homes to move it back, you know? And I don't mean back as in backwards, but move things in the direction that we want them to go. And that's the only way, you know, we have to fix everything at the source, right? And when you said insulating the children, Cecily, you know, and you said they're not insulated, obviously, like, they're in bad situations in their home, and that's why they're having these problems. But then they are being insulated from the portion we shouldn't be insulating from. It's like, it's like they face these bad situations, so then we put on the kid gloves where we should be taking the gloves off, right?
We further victimize them.
Yes.
By treating them like victims. Like, when that becomes their sole identity and we play into that. And they are victims. That's the thing. They are victims. But they're a human first, right? And if we make that their sole identity and keep playing into that, we're continuing to victimize them.
Yeah. Yep. I had a scenario a while back with a gal, a young girl, and she's going through a rough home situation. And she had kind of smarted off at me and told me that it wasn't her job to everything wasn't her responsibility, and, like, had smarted off. And I said, you're not allowed to act like that, you know, and she finally broke down and said, you know, things were rough at home. And I said, that's fine. I said, you come talk to me. I am here to listen to you, and I will gladly help you through that situation. But this is not how we handle that situation, by acting out in other ways. Like, you're not allowed to just act like this because you have a rough situation. And it totally changed the scenario. And I think a lot of times in these situations, be it at school, church, wherever, when you're a leader for these kids and we want to help them, like you said, coddling them isn't always the way. It's being kind and giving them that love and support where they need it, but also giving them that firm foundation of discipline where they need it as well. Because often when the love is lacking, the discipline is also lacking, and discipline and love go hand in hand.
Oh, absolutely. Like, what would our children be like if we never disciplined them? I say that to my kids all the time. They're like, why are you doing this? I'm like, because I love you. You know, like, simple things like, why can't we have more candy? Because I love you, right? Like, because I love you, we're putting up this boundary, you know? But my husband had a similar experience. Well, he has experiences like this all the time, unfortunately. I don't know how he does it, but he recently had a kid basically say to him, not basically, he did. He said, I'm going to effing lay you out. Like, he's yelling this in the classroom in front of all the other students. And so my husband basically says to him, you know, I'd like to see you try. And then he sends him to the office. And so he was not welcome back in my husband's classroom until he came to him to, like, apologize and talk it out. And so there's, like, administration and counselors reaching out to my husband saying, well, can he write you a letter? Like, it's really hard for him to come to talk to you. And my husband is just like, no, like, he can't come back in the classroom until he talks to me face to face. And I admire that so much. Like, that's not an easy thing when he knows this kid's background and he knows this kid's home life. And he does have compassion for him. He cares about this kid. But because he cares about him, he wasn't going to make it easy. you know, mm-hmm. and that's going to be hard for some people to hear because, you know, there are people that are going to disagree with this and think, no, because of their situation, we need to be extra careful. And I do agree. But I think by being extra careful, that means also helping them to be stronger. And this kid eventually came and talked to him, and he's welcome back in his classroom now. And it's going much, much better, you know, but it's just sometimes we have to do those hard things.
Yeah. And he's going to be better for it, I'm sure, you know.
I'm sure he'll remember that. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, that's going to be probably a defining moment for that kid.
Yeah, for sure. Man, we really got off the healthcare topic, but
I'm sorry.
Really, no, don't be. But this is the thing. Like, everybody that is in healthcare right now was once a student, was once a kid. And mm-hmm. this is why we constantly, I think, do come back to the parenting scenario and the children scenario yes. and the raising yeah. them up and educating, because everything we're experiencing right now is because of something like something in the chain that like a missing link, you know, yes. something broke, something was missing. And this is why we're experiencing what we are now. So,
yeah. And I think something else that we just need to remind ourselves of and everybody of is, this is going to sound off track, but it's not off track. Just bear with me. We live in the US and Canada in systems where we vote our government into their positions. They don't inherit the throne. They don't just get appointed by, you know, a select group of people. We vote them into their positions, which means that we are also in a leadership position. And yeah, it's different, obviously, than the leadership position that the people are in that we voted into those positions. But we are not powerless in this situation. This is not a monarchy situation. We are not powerless. We have a vote. We have a voice. We can get in touch with people that run the government. And in addition to that, to the fact that we vote people in, we vote in the people that figure out healthcare. We vote in the people that figure out education and all of these broken systems that we're talking about. And we also pay taxes, right? Mm-hmm. We pay taxes, whether you homeschool or private school or public school, access private healthcare or public healthcare, you pay taxes, which means you have a say, you have a share, you have a voice. Like, we are not victims to the system. We don't have to be.
Yeah. I really want to say something right now, but I don't know if I should. I told Levi, this is, I feel like you sometimes have these really great things to say, and then I come in with a stupid story. But while back, like, we were talking about, like, how do we stop this? And I had told Levi, like, this is probably a year ago, I was like, you know what would stop it real fast? If everybody stopped paying taxes. And literally last week, some like big commentator posted, so when do we stop paying taxes? I was like, man. But
yeah,
really, like, everything you said is absolutely correct. And I will say, in addition, like, mm-hmm. you can twist some of the things, you know, into a different scenario where you say, like, in a way, there is like an anointed one sometimes because of like how the money flows and how people, how these election processes go. But the main thing that I think people need to remember is the local level. Everything starts locally.
Local level, yes.
Home, you know, local community, county, state, like, and then on out, you know. So
yes.
those school board members you vote for, that's important. That's that's where it all starts, you know, your county board members. Those things are important. Mm-hmm. And there's definitely room for you to make a difference there, even if you don't believe in the bigger picture.
Yeah, I truly believe that, like, local is the way to go. It's the place to start. And most people, there's less, in most places, there's less corruption at the local level.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Corruption gets bigger the further upstream you go. But at the local level, it's mostly people that want to make a difference, right? That's at least how it starts out. And unless you're living in a town like the Duttons from Yellowstone, chances are your local government is not that corrupt.
Well, or if there is, I'm thinking of a specific scenario where I know there is corruption in a very small community. Yeah. But if there is corruption, everybody knows about it usually.
Yeah.
And if you want to hold people accountable, you can. But it's up to you to have the guts to do it. And I don't mean it sounds really bad coming after you saying the Duttons. Like, I don't mean in that manner. Like that. I just mean verbal accountability.
Yeah, yeah. We don't want to go all Yellowstone. yeah, totally. And I think there's this misconception that to be a good citizen, a good person, a good neighbor, you need to be meek. And yes, meekness is important. And I'm not saying don't be, but you don't have to switch off your brain and you don't have to stop having convictions and passions. You need to just deal with those things rightly and know that you have a voice. Mm-hmm. You're not wrong for using your voice.
This episode covered a lot of ground, Cecily.
Sure did. And before we started, you're like, I think this will be a short one. Like, it doesn't have to be super long. And here we are almost an hour in.
Healthcare to educating children and disciplining children to elections.
Yellowstone. I mean,
yeah, we got it all.
Yes, sure did. Check those boxes. Anyway, I think that's it, because if we keep going, you know, it could end up somewhere real, real sketchy. You never know. So let's wrap it up before things get out of control. But if you want to find us outside the podcast, as always, you can find me, Cecily, on Instagram at cecily.dickey or on my website, thegracetogrow.com.
And you can find me, Rita, at ritarogersco.com or Rita Rogers Co. on Instagram. Thanks for listening.